Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Revived Thoughts is a production of Revive Studios.
This is Troy and Joel, and you're listening to Revive Thoughts.
Identifying himself completely with his role as the precursor, he found perfect happiness in shrinking himself in the glory of Christ, just as the dawn disappears in the splendors of the morning.
Every episode, we bring you a different voice from history and a sermon that they delivered. The sermon is given to us by Charles Wagner. It was preached in the late 1800s. It's titled, I Am a Voice. Troy, how are you doing? I am allergy-ricken, and you are recovering from a cold, so we have a nasally gang together today.
We do, and not a cold, a flu. I was out. I was unable to move. It was terrible. Probably, it's spring break where we are. The kids are out of school for a week. We should have been able to have all kinds of fun, and I was completely worthless, and I felt very bad about it because I was really looking forward to all the spring break shenanigans I could get into with the kids, and I wasn't able to get into any of them. So that was disappointing. You sound like you have allergies, and if I remember Kansas City, where you are at, that means you're going to have lots of pollen and then probably two more snows before summer hits.
Out of control. Yeah, we got second winter that's still coming, but in the meantime, we're getting hit with the freight train of pollen. Worse than it's ever in my life. It is awful. Like, to the point where, like, I'm considering, like, a sick day. Like, legitimately, like, I cannot function and interact with people because my eyes are too watering and too itchy, and I'm sneezing constantly, and it's just wild. But I am glad you're feeling better, Troy. That's no fun. That stinks. It is kind of a surreal thing for an adult to be so sick that you just, like, have to lay for a whole day. I've been there, and it's weird. This is life.
I feel like as someone overseas who gets a lot of stomach bugs, gets a lot of migraines and stuff like that, or has gone through a lot of those, it's not unusual to get sick overseas. Pretty normal thing to have those moments. I have not been stuck in bed and like my head hurting so bad I can't even pick up my phone. So I'm literally just, there's nothing going on. But I also am in too much pain to sleep. That was a very, like, I haven't experienced that, I feel like, in a very long time. But anyway, all right, so we're Revived Thoughts, and if you're new, we don't normally start the show with so much complaining.
It's just sick talk.
good timing on that cough, Joel.
Yeah.
All right, so Joel, there have been some positive responses to Revived Thoughts. I wanted to read a few of those. From Phil over on Twitter, another great episode from Revived Thoughts. He shared this one. I think we all fall into these traps, and I definitely like to see a reclaiming of teaching church history and history in general properly, more objectively, in a storytelling manner. And that was on our episode, How Not to Teach Church History, that he shared out on Twitter. Thank you for sharing that, Phil. And also, I got to tell you, we've heard a lot of people, just personal people reaching out and sending messages about that episode. And we are really glad, both on Revived Thoughts and Martyrs and Missionaries, people have been saying, yeah, I needed to hear this. You know, we need more of this. How do we teach church history? And so I'm glad that that's been able to kind of get people thinking about that important subject. Now, this one, I really like this one. Mark Stadock, I'm not sure, on Twitter says, my boy, he tags his friend, at Breaking Idols, got a cool shout out on my at Revived Thoughts podcast. He's pretty much famous now. And then he said, no, yes, I'm just now listening to something that was from mid-January. I was busy. Get off my back. Well, Mark, I'm going to get off your back about listening to that episode and being a little late on it, because I think I'm a little bit late to reading this comment. It's been like probably a week and a half since you made it. However, Mark, I just want to say, now you got a cool shout out for shouting out Breaking Idols. You got a cool shout out. And now we've created like a shout out cycle now. Yeah. And I hope some other guy will go, hey, look, Mark was on, and he'll get shouted out. And this thing can just kind of continue vortexing, and we'll see where it goes. We also have Caillou Buck. All of these are on Twitter today. He was sharing our link on Spotify, an older episode he shared out from B.B. Warfield, The Example of the Incarnation. That is an old one. And he shared, I've been checking out some of the older episodes of the, quote, the world's best church history podcast, end quote. I hope that's just a phrase you've been using around the office or something. Like, I don't think that's one of our slogans. So thank you for giving us that name. And he said, if you have not listened to Revive Thoughts, you are missing a true treasure. And then he hashtagged it Eric with a K. Thank you, Caillou Buck, or Eric with a K. Not sure which one we got there for sure. But we appreciate you listening to some of those older episodes. I'm always excited when people go back and listen to the Treasure Trove. We have almost 5 years worth of content, and all of the sermons are just as revived 4 years ago as the ones that are revived fresh every Thursday. So they're great for enjoying, and we hope you guys will continue to go back and check them out.
Yeah, he was linking an old episode back when we had the orange logo, yes. The orange icon. That feels like a lifetime ago. But it listeners, if you were following us back in the orange thumbnail era, you're the real, you're the OGs, the original listeners.
You know, if you're out there and you remember the orange icon because you were there from back when that was the orange icon, you should shout us out when this episode comes out. Send us something on Twitter or Instagram or somewhere. Let us know and say, hey, I remember the orange icon. We'd love to hear from those orange icon fans.
All right, Charles Wagner, Troy, what is our confidence level? give me a 0 to 100% on if this is pronounced Wagner or Wagner. So I mean, we're saying Wagner, but he's Northeast France. I would say the majority percentage, 60% chance he was called a Wagner.
Yeah.
What do you think?
No, I actually agree with you. I think percentage wise, you are correct, but our ability to be forgiven is higher if we err on the side of Wagner. In case that he's not, if we call him Wagner and he's actually Wagner, or and he's from France, I don't know how, you know, Chorle Wagner, right? Maybe. That sounded more vampire than it is French.
Wagner. Oh, boy.
You've been to France, Joel. You should know how to say this.
Yeah, that's how that works. You visit once and you're a linguistic expert.
We're going to go with Wagner purely out of, I think that makes it easier to forgive us if we're wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, true Wagners that live in America now are usually called Wagners by now. Like, it's been Americanized over the years. I don't know. We'll probably get some people writing in about that. I don't know. I've definitely known Wagners that were definitely Wagners 500 years ago, you know? True. But now they're Wagners, yeah. So we're going to call them. Charles Wagner, born in Northeast France in the year 1852, from a Lutheran family. His pastor was part of the local Lutheran church. At 14 years old, he moved away to Strasbourg to work on his college degree. And back in the day, Strasbourg, at the time, was a big deal. It was one of the biggest cities in the region in France there. And this was like a pretty common thing in this era. I mean, I guess we still see it in today, but not as much as far as just like sending your kid away to a major city to study. It sounds like something that'd be scary.
The number of times, especially in this era of like continental Europe, where like someone's just like, and then at 12, I sent my child off to a city far away to learn to study. And we say it so casually, but I feel like it would be terrifying in a pre-internet, pre-phone age to just be like, you're 12 now, son. I'm sending you to London to go learn to study. Don't get into any shenanigans, you know, don't be doing anything bad while we're gone. I feel like that's I don't know. It stood out to me for the first time.
Looking forward to my monthly letter from you.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear how all is well. And we'll let you know if all of your brothers and sisters are still alive in those monthly letters.
Yeah. That is a different mindset of raising families for sure. After he finished his schooling there in Strasbourg, he moved to Germany to further study, and he finished with some theological degrees. Now, up until this point, again, he was kind of raised in that Lutheran tradition, so he considered himself Lutheran. But after finishing his studies, he wanted to be a part of what is called, quote, the French Protestant Church. It's something that, Troy, correct me on this, we would think of it more of as like a Reformed theology today, yeah?
Yeah, it is considered that. I mean, you go to his Wikipedia, the first thing he says is he's considered a Reformed theologian. So at least okay. Of his time, that would be where that comes from. However, he would be considered, I think, in the liberal wing of the Reformed theologian camp. And if those titles don't mean anything to you, then don't worry about them. But if you're very interested in stuff like that, that's where you would go. All right. For a few years, he worked a small church before deciding with his newly married wife that he would like to move out of Strasbourg, out of Germany, out of those places he's been living in, and go to Paris. Paris, you know, just as it is today, the center of France. But when he got there, he found that none of the churches were interested in letting him preach, maybe because of his back and forthing, maybe because they weren't really sure what, quote, the French Protestant churches were, this new kind of denomination, which is interesting because Protestant in France seems like it's something they understood. They had a whole movement called the Huguenots, and if you've never listened to Elisa's Martyrs and Missionaries, you should go check it out on them. But this French Protestant church, as labeled, as I just said, it seems to be like a new kind of movement, ecumenical reformed movement that he was leading, and people just didn't know who he was. So instead of getting a church to let him start preaching, the French Protestant church movement he was a part of said, you can start your own Sunday school and church right where you are. Now, Wagner, I don't think he grew up rich. Like, I didn't see any evidence that this guy was loaded, but I also didn't see any evidence he was poor. He seemed like he lived upper, you know, maybe middle class, at least not. He wasn't peasant poor. He wasn't D.L. Moody poor. He seemed like he was doing fine. But when he moved to Paris, him and his wife purposely took up a tiny apartment in the poor district of Paris. And that's also where they set up the church. They figured that in their minds, his kind of philosophy was, who needs the power of God's hope the most? The poor who are in the most suffering do. So that's where the church should set up its front door. And that's where the pastor of that church should be sharing the good news with the people who need it the most.
Yeah, so he would eventually get his church built for the equivalent of a cool $60,000. And that's in today U.S. adjusted money. So a bargain. And a quarter of that would end up coming from Americans because, and this is very interesting, he's quite an entrepreneurial man here. He was a relatively successful author, book publisher. He published several books and would sell them around the world, and they resonated well with Americans. Specifically, Theodore Roosevelt was a big fan of Charles Wagner's writings. Which is like the best promotion you can get, the best hype you can get. When Theodore Roosevelt is peddling your book, you're doing all right. So much so that, again, a quarter of their church fund came from Americans buying his books. He wrote a lot. His most famous book is called The Simple Life. And this is interesting. It's actually a concept that I've seen resurface more recently. I wonder, there's like a current author called Jean-Marc Comer who talks a lot about similar concepts, and surely he had to have been semi-inspired to it, but talking about how one of the major problems about society and life was that it has become too complex. There were too many things to do, too many things to keep track of between business and politics and sports and economics. All of these things were too much to keep track of, and we're not like really meant to keep track of that. In The Simple Life, the book, he challenges us to let go of all that and to live a more simple life, to wheedle down how busy we are. Again, Roosevelt loved it. It was a huge sensation. I think it's interesting just to think about, you know, someone 200 years ago saying, okay, we're too busy, and then looking at our lives today, realizing we're way busier than people were 200 years ago. And, you know, surely the same concepts apply to us here and now. Hey, who knows?
I mean,
who knows? Not in 200 years what life will look like.
It's a great point, because back then they, you know, when they went to bed at night, there was no device or anything to keep them awake. They closed their eyes, right? And then when there was no important pressing Revive Thoughts podcast to catch up on, their lives were in that way a lot easier than they are today. So it's an interesting point. Like, 100 years ago, people needed to simplify things, and that was a big hit, how much more is it now? But then, you know, the reverse of that's true, too. He told them all 100 years ago to simplify, and no one listened. And, you know, how many times, no matter how much we seem to know, that we get ourselves too busy, and we make ourselves, our lives too full of stuff, we don't ever actually stop. We just keep adding more and more in, so... Mm-hmm. Listeners, look at your life. Are you too busy? Maybe you need to take the subscriptions that aren't Revive Thoughts and Martyrs and Missionaries and turn them down.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
So he agreed to go along. He goes to America and speaks at the White House, you know, preaches there. It goes very well. He does a little tour through America, and that's how he's able to raise a lot of the money he needs to build that church in that poor part of Paris, where he wanted to reach the poor and the hurting. He did a few other things too. He started this committee that helped get working men jobs so that they wouldn't be just kind of on the streets. This one I thought was interesting, and I will say, like, look, I don't even know if I agree with this, but it's something I could see people doing today. That's why I thought it was worth bringing up. He set up something called the Moral Action Committee, which basically sought to unite people from different backgrounds, whether they were atheist, Christian, Jewish, or undecided, to fight for what was right for France. And what he meant by that was basically the Moral Action Committee, this group that he formed, and it was like a political group almost, not like a political party, but like a political lobbyist group. I'm not sure. But the idea was not we're all on the same page about God. The idea was like we're not all on the same page about God, but we are all on the same agreement that we need to stand up for what is moral before it gets worse. And what was interesting to me about that was I feel like that's something that, and I'm not saying it's even good, I'm just saying I feel like that's something that people could start in America today, a moral action committee where they say, look, atheists, you know, same exact group, atheists, Christians, Catholics, Jews, wherever you are, we don't all agree in the same afterlife, but we all agree that the direction things are going today aren't good. And I just thought it was interesting. I can't think of another guy I've seen try to do that where
really hard to imagine that happening in today's day and age.
Really, I actually think the opposite. I almost think that that is something that a lot of people would actually get behind, where they go, yeah, we all agree. In some ways, you can almost argue the political parties are that, aren't they? Where they don't really agree on God, but they agree on the morality of where things should go. Interesting. We had the exact opposite takeaway.
I would love for it to happen, but I did.
Well, that's the thing. I think it could happen. Divisive. I don't know if it's good. I haven't. We were like in the exact opposite camp. Yeah. We are as fully. I was going to say, I could see it happening, but I don't know that it's a good thing to try to get these different groups to unite. Because I think that, like, as Christians, we should really work with Christians and be evangelizing the lost. And yeah, I guess, I don't know, is that what a political party is? Boy, he really got me there. So I don't know if I'm just not philosophical enough to be able to handle this, but hey. So that was what he started, and I don't know how well it worked because, I mean, within 10 years, France was in World War I, and I think that kind of changed the direction of France dramatically. All right, so this is Charles Wagner, a very interesting guy, had a very interesting life, and this is his sermon, I Am a Voice.
I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord. John chapter 1, verse 23. Nothing is rarer than an independent personality. So many causes, both interior and exterior, hinder the normal development of human beings. So many hostile forces crush them. So many illusions lead them astray that it requires a working of extraordinary circumstances to render possible the existence of an independent character. But when God alone knows at the cost of what efforts and of what happy accidents, a vigorous and original personality has been able to unfold, nothing is rarer than not to see it degenerate into a mere celebrity. History teaches us that men exceptional in will and energy almost always become obstructive and mischievous. They start by serving a cause and end by taking possession of it so completely that from being its servants, they become its masters. Instead of being men of a cause, they make the cause that of a man, and they degrade the most sacred realities to the paltry level of their ambitious egoism. So when we meet with those of strong natures endowed with the secret of leadership and command, yet able to resist the subtle temptation to which so many of the finer spirits have succumbed, it behooves us to bow and to salute them. If ever a soul encompassed this greatness, it was that of John the Baptist. John is little known. Of him, there remain only a few traits of looks and a few snatches of his speeches. But these snatches are full of character. These traits give us the vision of a sculpture. Just as with the broken trunks of columns, these fragments of stones, with all that is left of temples that were once marvels of ancient art, they enable us to conceive of the grandeur of the whole structure to which they once belonged. John was at once strong and humble, energetic and self-detached. Never has an individuality so well-tempered been less personal. Identifying himself completely with his role as the precursor, he found perfect happiness in shrinking himself in the glory of Christ, just as the dawn disappears in the splendors of the morning. History is full of precursors who impede and withstand those whom they had first announced. When the time comes to retire and to give away to those for whom they prepared the way, they don't have the courage to sacrifice themselves. They go on forever and often become the worst enemies of the cause they have defended. John knew nothing of these failings, which are the perpetual scandal in the development of the kingdom of God. Not only did he say, speaking of Jesus, he must increase, but I must decrease, but he made all his acts conform to these words. This is my joy therefore fulfilled, he said as he dwelt upon the first advances of the gospel, and he expressed a sweetness of sacrifice forever unknown to personal souls that remain vulgar in spite of their genius. Finally, John described himself metaphorically in that inimitable prophetic speech, which explains in full the idea that he formed for himself of his ministry. Under the sway of a morbid curiosity, the crowd, more perplexed by the appearance of the worker than attentive to the work, pestered him with questions. Who then are you, mysterious preacher? Are you one of the old prophets of Israel escaped from his rocky tomb, or are you the perchance he whom we await? No, answered John. I am neither one of the prophets nor the Messiah himself. I am no one. I am a voice. I am a voice. This is not a formula that sums up the vocation of the prophet solely, or of all of those who, in the pulpit or in the tribune, by the pen or by the public discourse, exert an influence upon their contemporaries. These words are addressed to everyone. They define for every man the humble yet great duty of the truth that he's called to fulfill in his sphere and according to the measure of his ability. At the epoch in which we live, such a device is so applicable to the time being, so pressing, so needful for us to hear, that it is wise to engrave it in the very foreground of our consciousness. To become a voice, we must begin by keeping still. We must listen. The whole world's a tongue of which the spirit is the meaning. God engraved its fiery capitals in the immensity of the heavens and traced its delicate smaller letters on the flower, on the grass, on the human soul, as rich, incommensurable as the abysses of space. Whoever you are, brother, before letting yourself utter one word, lend your ear to that voice that seeks you. I might also add that implores you. Listen. Listen to the confused murmur that arises from the human depths, and that, comprising in all its tears, all torments, as well as all joys, becomes the sigh of creation. Listen in your heart to remorse, the sad and poignant echo that sin, traversing life, leaves everywhere upon its passage. Shut your ear to no sound, however unobtrusive, however sad it may be. There are voices that issue from the tombs, others that call to you from out the abyss of past ages. Repel them not. Listen, one and all. They have something to say to you. But do not be content with listening to man. Pierce nature, an invisible creation, as is the invisible sanctuary of souls. Watch attentively for the revelation of him whose eternal thought of every living thing, humble or sublime, translates after its own fashion. He speaks to you in the dark nights and in the bright light of dawn, in the infinite radiance of the worlds beyond all reckoning, and in the humble cornstalk that awaits, in the valley bottom, its ray of light and its drop of dew. Listen, if there is anguish in the voice of poor humanity, there are in great nature profound words of soothing, of hope. Look at the flowers of the field. Listen to the birds of the skies. After the distressed voices that perturb you, you will know the voices that relieve and console. All those who have become voices have traveled this way, at Patmos or in the desert, on Horeb or on Sinai. They've trembled with fright or started with joy. But everything has its time. There comes a day when all voices, soft or terrible, that man has heard, grow still, to let there only be one heard, the voice which cries to him, "Go, go now and be a witness of the things you have heard. Go, I send you forth as lambs among wolves. Go, I send you toward men whose brow is harsh, whose heart is wicked, but fear nothing. I will embolden your face. I will give you a heart of brass and a forehead of diamond." When that moment has come, one must, in order to remain faithful to his mission, remember that after all, he is only a voice. Truth does not belong to us. It is we who belong to truth. Woe to him who possesses it and treats it as something that belongs to himself. Happy is he who is possessed by it. No preference, no kinship, no sympathy counts here. Alas, it is not so that men understand it. It is for this reason that they degrade truth and that it becomes without power in their hands. Instead of winging its way heavenward in vigorous flight, it crawls along the earth like an eagle whose wings have been broken. Nothing is sadder than to see how those who ought to lend their voice to truth turn it to their own uses and play with it. The voice, human speech, that sacred organ whose whole worth lies in sincerity, has all ages been the victim of odious profanities. But in this age, it is more than ever attainted. The evil from which it suffers is defilement. At certain epochs, a word was as good as a man. It was an act totally supreme, guaranteed by the whole of life. There was no need to sign, to stamp, to legalize. Speech was held between friends and enemies alike, more sacred than any sanctuary, and man maintained it with the obscure but just sentiment that it is at the base of society, and that if words lose their value, there's no longer any society possible. Later, the written word was considered sacred, and coming nearer to our own day, we've been able to see the masses, guided ever by that quite legitimate sentiment of the holiness of speech, regard everything printed as gospel truth. Those times are no more. We've lied too much by the living word, the pen, and the press. We've said and printed too much that's light, false, wittingly disfigured. Armed with an instrumentality that multiplies thought and spreads its broadcast to the four corners of the earth with a rapidity unknown to our fathers, we've made use of it, for the most part, to extend slander more widely and to cause a greater amount of doubtful intelligence to swarm upon the earth. So well have we spun speech out in all our mouths, so thoroughly have we deprived it of its proper nature and caused it to become sophisticated, that it's no longer of the least value. The confidence of the masses in authority, which is one of the slowest and most difficult conquests of humanity, we have lost like a thing of no worth. But no longer say to anyone who now lifts up his voice, "Who are you? But what are you trying to gain? What party do you serve? By what interest are you led? By whom have you been bought?" That there may be a sacred truth, loved, respected, adored, a truth that's worth more than life, to which one may give himself wholly and with happiness. This idea is lost to the cynics and makes those whom the cruel experiences of life have rendered distrustful shake their heads. If ever an epoch is needed to rehabilitate human speech, it's our own. What good are we if it's good for nothing, since it's at the root of all our institutions? Who will give back its power? They who will know how to resign themselves to being only a voice. Permit me to bring home to you, by means of a very modest example, what man may gain in force by being but a voice. Look at that clock. When the hours come, it marks it. Whether it be the hour of birth or death, the hour of joy or of sorrow, the hour of longed-for meetings or of heartbreaking farewells, the clock strikes that hour. It's only a mechanism, but it's scrupulously exact. It measures that time which descends to us drop by drop from the bosom of eternity. And when the hammer falls on the brazen bell, the entire universe confirms what it announces. The sun and the worlds mark at this very moment, in the immortal light, the same point of time that's indicated below on earth, some starless night, by the humblest village clock. We must imitate the clock. In full consciousness, through absolute submission, man should make himself the humble instrument of truth and go through supreme servitude to supreme power. When he does not do this, he's only an imperfect timepiece. But when, bound by his word, chained to the truth that he serves, he has become its slave, and when without hate, without preference, without human fear, without other desire than of being faithful, he proclaims what is just, right, true, good. The rocks are less firm on their base than this man, for he is a voice. A voice, if you like, a slight thing. Stilled as soon as it awakened, it's only heard by a few and only for a little while. It's said that singers are greatly to be pitied, since posterity cannot hear them. Nothing of that remains. And yet how many marvelous forces underlie this apparent fragility? The thunder has its roar, the breeze has its tenderness, but their power is transitory. They're sounds and not voices. A voice is a living sound. It's the vibrant echo of a soul. It's doubtless that most fragile thing, a breath, but joined to that which is most durable, spirit. And it's for this reason that if the instant when it is born sees it die, centuries of centuries cannot destroy its effect. The truth which is in it confers immortality upon it. And when this voice escapes from the human heart, he who speaks, sings, or weeps feels indeed that eternity has concluded an alliance with him. The holy labors entrusted to the voice can never be counted. Because of the very fact that it lives and contains a soul, it's the great awakener, the incomparable evoker. When obscure, still, and unknown, a thought distracts us and slumbers at the bottom of our being, a voice is all that's needed to make it emerge into the light. With maternal tenderness, the voice borrows all the energies of incubation to infuse with warmth, to fortify the nascent germs of spiritual life. In it lives and breaks out what, in the evolving soul, tends feebly and furtively toward the flowering. In short, the voice, speech, the tongue, condenses in a single focus incalculable quantities of rays. Only think of the efforts that human thought must have made to reach that clearness that enables it to become speech.
Every word that you utter without giving it a thought is a monument toward which centuries and multitudes of minds have brought. A world's contained in it. Poor words. One man decks himself out in them, another wraps himself up in them. But how few know of the warmth of the life and love that's put them into the world, that they may be forever witnesses of the past for posterity. No matter, for when they have been made sufficiently to resound like an inanimate symbol, there comes an hour where they revive under the breath of a true and living being, and they depart to spread life. Then they fulfill their role as teachers. To teach is to explain a being to itself. And this is the benign service that the voice performs. It tells us what we think better than we can ourselves. It unbinds the chains of the captive soul and permits it to take its flight. Happy the child, happy the young man who meets with a voice to decipher him to himself. This is what Christ did in those blessed hours when he reunited the children of his people, as a bird reunites its brood under its wings. When the voice does in detail, it continues to accomplish on the larger scale. At certain moments, societies seem a prey to a sort of chaos. A number of contradicting forces clash and perturb them, as they perturb and tear at individual souls. Men seek, feeling their way, a road that seems to elude them. A crowd of spirits, by the very fact of their coexistence, feel themselves distracted and agitated all in the same way. Confusedly and provoked by the same sufferings, they elaborate the same ideal and formulate the same desires. But they all wander along twilight paths on the side of the night where the light seems to be breaking through, without, however, being able to pierce the darkness. These are the preliminary agonies of the great historical epochs. Then, let a being more powerful, more vital, an elect soul that's passed through this phase and conquered these shadows, become incarnate in a voice. That's enough. The personal word which expresses the soul of that epoch in response to its needs is found. It sounds through the world like a new "Let there be light." Everywhere, in those who listen to it and feel its secret affinities with it in themselves, it constitutes a magnificent revelation of light and life. All these hearts vibrate in unison with one, and gathering up all these sacred notes into a single harmony, he who expresses the sentiments of all renders an account of the wonderful power of which he's the instrument. No, it's no longer a man that speaks. What sounds upon his lips is the whole soul of a people, is a whole epoch, is a new world. A voice is also that inimitable sigh, that pure sob, which tells of grief because it issues from a suffering heart. It's pity and compassion. It's the angel of God arriving among us on the caressing breath, a messenger of mercy, and pouring into the tortured depth of our poor heart with its healing dew. It's Jesus saying to Mary, and in her to all those whom grief afflicts, "Why do you weep?" It's David singing, "Why are you cast down, O my soul?" It's Isaiah crying, comfort you, my people, speak you comfortably to Jerusalem. A voice is on the solitary path where our will strays, the faithful shepherd calling his sheep. It's every sign, even though it's made by the hand of a child, which in the days of forgetfulness and unrestrained, suddenly wakes up and warns us that our feet are crossing into the abysses. Then, after the work of teaching, of creation, of pity, comes the work of severity, of punishment, of destruction. The voice has been compared to a sword. Like it, it burns and punishes. A voice is Nathan rising up before the criminal king and calling down upon his head the avenging lightning of his word. You are the man. The sword attacks, destroys, but it defends also, and this is its fairest work. Never is the voice more touching than when it's lifted in favor of the weak, and when suddenly, in the midst of iniquities, a brute force that it denounces marks with a stigma. It causes justice to shine out and truth to be felt. In the holy soul-traversing thrill that God himself is there and that his hour has come. A voice has its echo. When this echo is sympathetic, it's endowed with the sweetest recompense and obliterates the memory of many sorrows. But this echo is often hostile. It arises from wrath and is increased by hatred. Then it's resistance, riot, that rumbles. It's the passions and the scourged vices that twist and bellow like horses under the lash of the trainer. How many times, O faithful voices, souls of peace and truth, has the spirit that animates you driven you to these fearful encounters? You who have heard in the silence of your hearts the holy truth and who know their worth, you are obliged to go bearing them in the face of menace, of mockery, of trembling rage, where they seem to us like Daniel in the lion's den, a terrible ordeal. But one before which the testifying voices have never recoiled, Luther, who knew the emotions of the great battles of the spirit, where one man's alone in the face of a thousand, where tinder the growing clamors and the cries of death, a voice struggles like a torch in a hurricane, has given to the servants of truth a counsel that's the alpha and the omega of their austere mission. When they've said all, done all, written all, put all their being and all their love into the proclamation of what they have to announce, then, he says, let them be ready to be hooted at and spat upon. And not only should they be ready, but they should accept this lot with happiness. Christ said to them, happy are they that are outraged and persecuted for the sake of justice. Alas, the rudest proof of him who speaks the truth is not to arouse indignation. That, at least, is a result, and however sad it may be, it bears witness to him who's spoken. Certain protests, despite their fury, are a sort of involuntary homage. The supreme trial for a voice is indifference. When John called himself a voice in the wilderness, he alluded to that external solitude where his voice was raised. But this solitude on certain days was full of life, and the gospel cites for our benefit certain facts which prove that the words with which it resounded were not lost in the empty spaces. They moved and struck home from the humblest regions of society to the exalted spheres, to the royal throne itself. John garnered love and hate, blessing and curse, the desirable fruits of all energetic action. After having spoken of the different voices, of their power, of the effects, let us bestow a compassionate remembrance upon the lost voices, on those who were or who are still, in the most lamentable sense of that word, voices in the wilderness. To be a man, a soul, to have felt the lightning of a holy flame within oneself, to love truth and justice, to feel the pain of contact with a life ruled over by falsehood and violence. At the heart of this poignant contrast between a divine ideal and a heart-rending reality, to receive from his conscience, from God himself, the command to speak, to put his life into this work, to renounce everything, to be only a voice. And after all this, to see himself forsaken, neglected, despised. To wear oneself out slowly in a strife obscure and without issue, to perish without having aroused either sympathy or opposition, to disappear into oblivion before disappearing in the tomb. Ah, all the furies, all the bloody reprisals, the dungeons, the gibbets, the massacres, all the martyrdoms by which human wickedness strove to stifle the voice of the just are less horrible than this extermination by apathy. And yet, not to press things into this cruel extremity, but remembering the parable of the sower, where so many seeds are lost for the few that take root and flourish, are we not willing to be, in the greatest number of cases, voices in the wilderness, only too happy if our thankless labors are recompensed elsewhere by an encouraging echo? Have we not here, on the contrary, the image of human life? We are always aspiring toward an ideal more elevated than that which we realize. We are always precursors, and it becomes us to accept humbly what that destiny holds of both pain and beauty. Besides, do we know whether voices that seem to be lost are truly lost? Are the stones that are hidden in the foundations of a beautiful structure, and thanks to which the whole fabric is supported, lost because no one sees them? In the same way, it must be that many voices are forgotten, apparently, until such time as, added together and finding each other in mutual support, they end by emerging into the full light of day. To wait and to work, to do his duty and leave the rest to God, to journey through life, gathering truth into his heart and then into the family, the church, the city, to be its faithful voice, this is the best use a man can make of his mortal days. And should it be your lot to be voices in the wilderness, among your children deaf to your cries, among your neighbors insensible to your warnings. Console yourselves. Greater than you have suffered the same fate. Unite yourself in spirit to their company, and be happy to suffer with them. At least you come to understand more and more from day to day that truth cannot perish, and that it is power even on feeble lips. You'll establish in your hearts faith in the world that endures, and you'll be less astonished and less disconcerted when you see the face of this world pass away. You'll live by the sacred fire cherished in your souls. Become old. Your hope will not perish. Like Moses on Nebo, you will enter the silence, having filled your dying eyes with the spectacle of the promised land.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Revived Thoughts. Today's sermon was narrated by John Raynor. Guys, John Raynor is a pretty big deal. He has done voice projects for Brad Pitt, for Sony, for General Electric. You can check out his work at johnraynor.com and hire him if you have any voice work needs.
Yeah, John Raynor has also done several episodes for Revive Thoughts. If you haven't listened to some of his others, he's fantastic, and you need to go listen to as many of them as you can. We have every listener, every speaker is wonderful, but we do have some people who've been able to do several repeat episodes, and Raynor is one of the best. And you should definitely, if you have voice work, go to him. He's amazing. If you enjoyed this episode of Revive Thoughts, all we're going to ask is that you leave us a rating somewhere, especially if it's Apple. But if you only can do somewhere else, leave it wherever you can. Leave us a rating, leave us a review. Let other people know that you are listening to Revive Thoughts. It helps us, and we read all of them as they come. This is Troy and Joel, and this is Revive Thoughts.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.